Our topic is, who's afraid of the big bad Greek? Why our sages feared Hellenism. And this is a story about assimilation, but a particular kind of assimilation. It actually reminds me of something that happened many years ago. When I was, I think it was when I was in Smicha, studying for the rabbinate at Yeshiva University, I spent a few weeks during the summer on a kollel program, essentially, in a community in a small town in the U.S. And the goal of the program was to learn in the mornings and hear a lecture of our own, although the community could participate, and then afternoon, evening, learn with people in the community and have classes for the community. And there was a program one evening, and I don't remember anymore what the title of the program was or what the context was for this, but a woman got up and she told a story about how she had been in a store in December and she saw a few kids who were from the local Jewish community standing and looking at a particular item near the counter in the store. I think it might have been a bicycle, but I'm not sure. And they were talking about how much they would love to get it. And one of them said to another, I hope my parents get it for me for Xmas. Which, that family did not observe Xmas, but he didn't want to say Hanukkah where he could be overheard. That story has remained with me ever since in terms of the pressures that Jewish kids feel and issues of and fears of the greater society in which we live. This is a time of year when forced assimilation, and particularly assimilation into Greek society, is very much on our mind. By the way, I don't know if you're hearing the noises from next door here. They're doing construction in the room next door, and it sounds like they're scraping the wall that we share between the rooms. So I apologize, and I'll just be as loud as I can. But this is a time of year when we think about forced assimilation, and particularly, as I said, assimilation into Greek society because of the story of Hanukkah. Right? When it comes to Hanukkah, we think about the Greeks as oppressive, King Antiochus prohibiting us from fulfilling our mitzvot. And if you take a look on the source sheet, you see source number one from the first book of Maccabees. The book of Maccabees is a story in its own right in terms of its origins. We don't actually have an original Hebrew edition, assuming there was an original Hebrew edition, whether it was written in Hebrew, written in Greek, written in what, is a longer discussion. But take a look at the text in source number one, which is from an English translation. It was not originally written in English, that I can tell you. And the king sent letters by messengers to Jerusalem and the cities of Judah. This is the Greek king. He directed them to follow customs strange to the land, to forbid burnt offerings and sacrifices and drink offerings in the sanctuary, to profane Sabbaths and feasts, to defile the sanctuary and the priests, to build altars and sacred precincts and shrines for idols, to sacrifice swine and unclean animals, and to leave their sons uncircumcised. They were to make themselves abominable by everything unclean and profane, so that they should forget the law and change all the ordinances, and whoever does not obey the command of the king shall die. So these are the royal decrees that we associate with Hanukkah. And that is certainly one element of assimilation, this forced, oppressive assimilation. If you take a look at source number two, you find as well another example from this time of year, although different in its origin. We are told here, this is from a volume called Masechet Sefer Torah. It is one of the many tractates that are added to the Talmud. They're from later than the time of the Talmud. And it says, one may not write a Torah in Ivrit or Ilmit, Mede or Greek. Ivrit, we know, is the original Hebrew script, what is often called Paleo-Hebrew, as opposed to the Hebrew script that we use today. Ilmit, I believe, would have been from somewhere in the Babylonian Empire, Elam. Medit, from the empire known as Media. And Yevanit, of course, is Greek. And then we're told, Shivim zikenim kasvu kolatara letamei amelech lashon Yevanit. 70 elders wrote the entire Torah for King Ptolemy in Greek. And that day was as bad for the Jews as the day when they made the golden calf. Because Torah could not be translated properly. So the translation of Torah into Greek is viewed as a disaster. And why did we translate it into Greek? According to source number 3, a Gemara in Megillah, it's because King Ptolemy compelled it. He insisted that the elders translate the Torah on his behalf. He wanted access to our secrets. Now, there's a lot to be said about why the Torah was translated. That's not the topic of the shir. But these are two examples of, in the first case, Jews being forced to leave Judaism, and in the second case, Jews being forced to translate the Torah into Greek in a way which would be inadequate as a translation of Torah so that they should have access to it. Wow, now they're drilling, apparently. You know, I was sitting in this room for literally an hour before we started this class, and there was no noise from next door. I think it must have been their lunch break. I'm going to just go next door and see what I can do. Hang on 1 second. Okay, so hopefully the noise will be reduced. So we have two examples, again, of the Jews being compelled in one case not to fulfill mitzvot, and in the other case to translate the Torah into Greek. And so we're talking here about being forced into something. Linda sends a message in the chat. If we can't write the Torah in Ivrit, does that mean that what we have is a translation? But no, what the again, Ivrit is the original Hebrew alphabet that we switch over into Ashurit. And what we're saying here is you're only allowed to write it in Ashurit, in the Hebrew alphabet that we use today. That's what it's saying. Yeah. It's not actually, longer discussion, the difference between writing it in other letters and writing it in translation. But I was only bringing it because I wanted to talk about the Greek issue at the end as opposed to the rest of it. Claudette. Sorry, Claudette, you were going to say?
If the Torah that we have is not an original, is there any original in existence?
So this is a bigger discussion in terms of what alphabet was used for the Torah originally. There's a discussion in the Talmud about the Luchos, the tablets that we received at Sinai, and whether those use the current alphabet, the Assyrian alphabet, or whether those used the original. It's a much bigger topic. I think I've talked about it before. I think there may be something that I've recorded on YU Torah about this, the changeover in alphabets. But it's really not what I was expecting to talk about today, and I don't want to go too far afield with the conversation. Those are examples of assimilation by compulsion. But there's another story here, and that is of assimilation by persuasion, in which Jews adopt Hellenism willingly. If you go back to that first book of Maccabees in source number 4, we are told in those days, this is earlier than source number 1. If you just look at the verse numbers, you can see that. In those days, lawless men came forth from Israel and misled many, saying, "Let us go and make a covenant with the Gentiles around about us, for since we separated from them, many evils have come upon us." It's bad for us to be separated from the nations. That doesn't work well. We need to be more like them. This proposal pleased them, and some of the people eagerly went to the king. He authorized them to observe the ordinances of the Gentiles, so they built a gymnasium in Jerusalem according to Gentile custom, removed the marks of circumcision, abandoned the Holy Covenant, joined with the Gentiles, sold themselves to do evil, all around a problem. And within that view, the fight of Hanukkah was not only between Jews and the Greeks in Syria, but rather between Jews and Hellenized Jews, right? Jews who themselves had decided to become more Greek. Interestingly, that doesn't stop with the end of Hanukkah. The Hashmonaim themselves, the Hasmoneans, adopt Greek ways after the story of Hanukkah. And that's something that Ramban discusses, but I brought you in source number 5, a piece from a historian, Lee Levine. Hasmonean Jerusalem, a Jewish city in a Hellenistic orbit. The Hasmoneans themselves quickly adopted Hellenistic mores. They instituted holidays celebrating military victories, as did the Greeks. They signed treaties with Rome and forged close alliances with the upper strata of Jerusalem society, whose Hellenized proclivities, as those of the Hasmoneans themselves, are attested by names such as Alexander, Diodorus, Apollonius, etc., etc. You see these names of the Hasmoneans, which are Greek names. And he goes on to say, in the subsequent period of Hasmonean rule from 141 to 63 BCE, instances of Hellenization within Jerusalem became much more commonplace. The document in the 14th chapter of the first book of Maccabees, recording the public appointment of Simon as ethnarch, high priest, and strategos, is written in a style strikingly reminiscent of documents from the Hellenistic world. The structure of the declaration, the extensive arguments invoked to justify and explain such appointments, the use of purple robes and gold ornaments by the Hasmonean ruler, the dating of an era commencing with Simon's appointment, and finally recording the text of this document on bronze tablets and placing them in a prominent place in the temple area and in the treasury, are all elements borrowed directly from well-known Hellenistic practice. So there is the assimilation by compulsion in the beginning that we saw, and there is also the assimilation by persuasion, or not even persuasion. Persuasion suggests we're being pushed. It almost sounds here like we weren't being pushed. We pushed ourselves effectively to adopt that, even worse. So you see multiple themes of assimilation in this story, and we get finally to one particular source, which is going to be really the basis for our discussion. Take a look at source number 6. It's a passage in the Talmud. The Hebrew's at the bottom of one side, the English is at the top of the next side. Tana Rabbanan, our sages taught, Kishatzaru beis chashmonai ze al ze. There was a time when there was a rivalry between two kings from the Hasmonean dynasty, or two potential kings, I should say, from the Hasmonean dynasty. It was a fight between the two of them. One was named Hyrcanus, and the other one was named Aristobulus, and each of them claimed the throne. So there was a siege from one against the other. Hyrcanus mi bifnim, v'Aristobulus mi bachutz. Hyrcanus was inside Jerusalem, and Aristobulus was outside Jerusalem. They're brothers. Everyone clear? Uvechol yom hayu mishalshim lem bekupa dinarin v'yumalan hem tamidin. Every day, those who were outside Jerusalem, Aristobulus's forces, would send in a carbon. They would send in a sacrifice that they would bring inside. Those inside sent out money from the collection that had been taken from the Jews as a whole, and those outside would send in the animals for the sacrifice. Haya sham zakin echad shayamakir b'chokhmas yevanis. There was one elder who was he was outside the city, and he knew what we will translate right now as Greek wisdom. We don't know what that means yet. Amar lam, and he said to the people inside, it's the other way around. He's inside. He says to the people outside, he says, Kolzman sha'oskin ba'avoda einim sarin b'yadchem. As long as the people inside are carrying out the temple service, you're not going to win. They're not going to be given over to you. So Lamachar Shilshlu Dinarin Bakupa, so the next day the people on the inside, Hyrcanus' group, send out money. Vehelem Chazir, and the people on the outside send a pig instead. Kaven Shegiela Chatzia Choma, when it gets halfway up the wall, Na'at Tsiparnav Bechoma, it stabs its nails into the wall. Vinizdaza Eretz Yisrael Arba Meos Parsa, and all of Israel, 400 parasangs by 400 parasangs, shakes. Ba'osa Shah Amru, and at that hour they said, Arur Ha'ishi Gadal Chazirim, cursed is the one who raises pigs. Va'arur Ha'adam She'ilamed Es B'no Chochmas Yivanis, and cursed is the one who teaches his son Greek wisdom. So this story has layers to it. As an example, Rabbi Shmuel Edels, also known as the Maharsha, says the pig here is meant to represent Rome. Because when the two brothers are fighting over the kingdom, one side brings in the Romans as an ally in the civil war, and the Romans, once invited in, stayed. And that ultimately leads to the destruction of the Second Temple. So that's a layer that's going on in this story. But I want to understand what this story has to do with the Greeks. The Greeks are long gone at this point. This is already after the events of Hanukkah. How did the Greek wisdom involved affect anything? What would you say? Any thoughts on how the Greek wisdom, like, okay, he told the story, he told this message with Greek wisdom, but that's not the story. So, Claudette, I'm not hearing you so well. There's something going on with your microphone, but I think what you said is that many Jews had adopted Greek custom. Right, but I don't understand why this story leads to a ban on Greek wisdom. I just that's what I'm missing here. It has nothing to do with Greek wisdom. I don't really understand what it is about the Greeks that we're concerned about or their wisdom. If it's about Greek practices, there's a lot to be said about Greek practices. But what does this have to do with their wisdom? The story is very strange. So let's try to understand what this is about. There are multiple schools of thought regarding what the issue was here. All of them surrounding a fear of, as Claudette said, assimilation. They're all related to assimilation in different ways. So as an example, the Rambam in source number 7, in his commentary to the Mishnah, regarding this, he says, Lefi shahayu machnis, or it might be that it should be mechanim, as haramazim shebedibur. V'chein dvarm she'inam kipshutam, eleyeshan inyan nistar chochma. What the Greeks did was that they introduced hints in their speech. And they would say things that were not to be understood on their simple layer, but as having some kind of a hidden meaning. This was unique to the Greeks. It was something that the Greeks did. They would tell what they wanted to tell in these sort of hints. And the reason why we are prohibited from doing this is because during the Second Temple, and he goes on and tells the story, and then he says, "V'davar zeh ein li safek shenishtaka v'lo nishar mimenu ba'olam hayom lo ma'at v'lo arba." He says, no one does this anymore. No one tells these riddles anymore. So don't worry so much about what this prohibition is, because no one's doing it anymore. But he says, hang on, Ricky. He says the issue was one of riddles. And we are not supposed to engage in that kind of communication. But he doesn't explain at all why that story leads to banning that kind of communication. It's really very hard to understand. Yes, Ricky?
When you said Greeks were introducing hints, made me think of the Trojan horse.
Yeah.
This is a way of the introducing things secretly.
Right.
We can call that technique the Trojan horse.
I suppose. I suppose you could. It's just, what I'm struggling with is just trying to understand what is it that we're worried about here with this Trojan horse. Like, this is about just communicating a message that was harmful in a story. Why does it lead us to not want to tell riddles? I mean, take a look at source number 8. Rabbi Yitzchak ben Sheshet Perfet, also known as the Rivash, gives an interesting explanation for what the riddles were. He says, I'm going to read my English translation just because of time. It appears to me that Greek wisdom is to speak in Greek in riddles and sealed language, so that the masses will not understand. Only those who have learned and become accustomed to those riddles. For example, and he gives examples that are not Greek. The Gemara in Erevin talks about the maids in Rebbe's house saying to each other, when the cup bangs the pitcher, the nisharim is eagles or vultures, fly off to their nests. What in the world did they mean? You have a cup that they use to get wine out of the barrel, and when it bangs the bottom of the barrel, that means you're out of wine. And at that point, the students all leave the meal. That's what they were saying, but they were saying it in this clever way. Also there, Rabbi Yossi Bar Asian said, prepare for me a shor mishpat with tur miskein, which is very strange. Literal translation, shor mishpat, an ox of justice. Tur miskein, a poor mountain. Prepare for me an ox of justice with poor mountain. What in the world does that mean? And the answer is, shor mishpat in Aramaic is tordin. Tordin is like tardin or tradin, which today I think in modern Hebrew is spinach, although it could have been beets for them. Their tradin has meant different things over time. And tur miskein, hang on Ricky, I'm not doing the modern Hebrew right now. And tur miskein is Aramaic for har dal. Tur is a har, miskein is dal. Har dal is like chardal, which is mustard. So what he wanted was tardin in chardal. But he was saying it in a clever way. That's the idea. So it's communicating through riddles. Now, what in the world? So there was an old man who told a riddle, and that led to some problem in this story with Yerushalayim. But what does that have to do with, like, why would you ban riddles? You should ban old men. Like, why are you banning riddles? What in the world is this about? If you take a look at source number 9, the Jerusalem Talmud, with the explanation of the Pnei Moshe, they asked Rabbi Yeshua a question. Maushi Alamed Adam is Bino Yevanis. May a man teach his son Greek? And his answer was, teach him when it is neither day nor night. Because you have to learn Torah all day and all night. You learn Torah day and night. So find a time that's not day and that's not night, and then you can have him learn Greek. To which they said, well, if that's true, you also can't teach your son a trade. Right? Torah all day and all night. That's it. So you can't teach your son a trade. So Rabbi Abba, Rabbi Ba in the Yerushalmi, which is Rabbi Abba, son of Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba, explained in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, no, it wasn't really about that. The reason not to learn Greek wasn't because you're supposed to be learning Torah at all times. The concern is for traders. What does that mean? So the Pnei Moshe explains on this passage of Moshe Margalit. He says, Tamahu shelo yelamed es bino yevanis shelo yehemakir bilashonam urimazam. The point is that you don't want your son to know their, the Greeks, language and their hints. Vayedei kein yargil lachatzar hamelach v'yimsor. He will become accustomed to hanging out in the king's court, and he is going to betray the Jews. So the issue is, if you get involved in their riddles, you become part of their circle, and that leads to our downfall. That's the idea. You follow? That's one school of thought. The Maharal of Prague argued that no, the issue is wasting time from studying Torah. That's what it's about. In source number 10, the Maharal writes, Sha'ar chokhmos asur lomod im lo al yedei Torah. So you're not allowed to learn other wisdoms other than what you pick up as part of learning Torah. Like the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot says, you can find everything in Torah. Shakol yotzei min haTorah, everything emerges from the Torah. Ube'inyan zeh yesh lomor osam. And that's how you're supposed to learn those things. Aval ba'atzmam, but on their own, mibli she'yetzei min haTorah, if it doesn't emerge from Torah, aser lomor chochmas yavanis. You're not allowed to learn Greek wisdom. Ken yeroi v'hu nachon. He says, this is what is correct. Now, that doesn't explain at all why Greek, per se. Right? And, in that case, it has nothing to do with our story about the pig. Right? This would have been just as true if that story with the pig never happened at all. How does that figure into the story with the pig? You're going to tell me that because they weren't studying Torah, they learned Greek, therefore they undermined everything with the pig. It's a very difficult idea to fit in. Rabbi Menachem Meiri offers a third and last approach in source number 11. He says, Kvar be'arnu, we've already explained b'Megillah in his commentary to Masachas Megillah, Shehu mimi'usharim shebelashonos, that the Greek language is among the best languages. He says, Rabbi Menachem Meiri says, Greek is awesome. Umikom akom, and yet, Chochma shalahem asur lelamda. You're not allowed to learn their wisdom. Mipnei shemoshechas libo shel adam. It draws a person's heart. Vahoreses harbe mipinos hadas. And it can destroy many of the cornerstones of Judaism. Their philosophy can lead us away from Torah. So three different approaches to what led to the ban. Approach number one. You communicate through their riddles, you become part of their circles, and that leads to betrayal. Approach number two, it's going to be time you invest in that is time you're not investing in studying Torah, and that in and of itself is undermining. And approach number three is you learn their philosophy, it's going to influence you to leave Judaism, become closer to the Greeks, betray other Jews, and so on. Clear? Those are the three considerations, all of which come under the banner of assimilation that we seem to be concerned about. Yes, Claudette.
I can understand all of this, what the rabbis listed there, because if I look at other societies, take simply Egypt. Egypt had its original language and religion, even before it became Islamic. And today, what they have is just a small community of Coptics. And in the Coptic, the language of Greek and the old Hebrew and the old Egyptian language is mixed. So right. They lost everything. So I can be, if we had gone in that direction, we would have lost everything.
Right. So the, you're saying the Greeks are influential. Not just on us, but in general.
The Egyptian society, and they lost their original writings.
Right. And for that matter, you can point to the Romans, right? The Greeks heavily, heavily influenced Rome. So there is that. In truth, we do have sources in Jewish law that prohibit studying that which can lead somebody away from Judaism. So if you take a look at source number 12, none other than the Rambam, who was certainly very well-versed in ideas outside of Judaism, says, "V'lo avodas kochavim bilvad hu sha'asur lahafnos achareya b'machshava." He says, not only are we not supposed to turn our thoughts to idolatry, "Ela kol machshava shehu goreim lo la'adam la'akor ikar me'ikareya Torah," but any thought which could lead to a person uprooting one of the Torah's basic principles, Muzarim anu shelo lalo salibenu. We're not supposed to put it into our heart. V'lo nasiach da'atenu lekach. We should not turn our minds to it. V'nachshov v'nimshach achrei erhuri halev, being drawn after the thoughts of our heart. Mipnei shedaito shel adam kitzarah, because a person's mind is short. It's limited. V'lo kaladeo sichodun lahasig ha'emes al buryo. And not everyone is able to comprehend the truth. It really can lead you astray. So the Rambam doesn't want us to study things that can lead us away from Judaism. So inevitably, when you start down that road, there are people who protest and say, but that's censorship. You're not supposed to censor things. But Rambam is arguing, and Judaism argues, that that's not necessarily true. We aren't necessarily supposed to study everything, just like we're not supposed to say everything. Society believes in freedom of speech. We have laws like Lashon Hara that say, no, don't say everything that you could say. Someone just last week asked me if Yosef told his father, if you remember the story in the beginning of Vayeshev, as it's reported in the Medrash, Yosef told his father about the things that his brothers were doing wrong. They were eating the Evermin Achai and so on. The Torah says that he brought Dibasam Ra'ah, bad word about them, to their father. So he says, but if they were really doing it, then it's not Lashon Hara. So I had to explain that's not true. Of course it's Lashon Hara to tell your father that your siblings are doing bad things. There may be cases in which it's warranted. There may be certain instances. But generally speaking, if you see someone doing something wrong, telling them directly, hey, that's wrong, may fulfill the mitzvah of tochacha, of educating others. Telling somebody else will generally be a violation of Lashon Hara. So a person has to be very, very careful about that sort of thing. We censor our speech, and we also censor that which we take in, not only what we put out, but also what we take in, for a few reasons. If you take a look, I brought you the Medrash in Bereishis Rabbah in source number 13. The Medrash there is troubled. It wants to know, with Avraham, Hashem says to Avraham, Hishalech lefanai vehyei tamim, walk before me, Hashem says to Avraham. I want you to go in front of me, which we understand to mean it's an imperative to Avraham, go tell people about Hashem and about Judaism. Noach never gets any such command. Instead, the Torah tells us that he walked with God, not in front of God, but with God. Es halokim hishalech Noach. So the Medrash in source number 13 is surprised. Why isn't Noach given the same instruction that Avram is given? And look what it says. Mashal avosha melech she'mishtakeya betit ava. You could compare Noach to a friend of the king who is sinking in thick clay. He tzitz hamelech v'ro, so the king looks out and sees him. Amarle, he says to him, acha ata mishtakeya betit halachemi. You don't need to sink into the clay. Come walk where I am and you'll be safe. So Noach is not somebody who is considered able to triumph over the world. Avraham is considered somebody who is able to. His society is different. Maybe the numbers are different. Maybe Avraham personally is different. But the point in this medrash is Hashem doesn't want Noach to go out proclaiming religious truth to the world. He doesn't think it's going to be good for him. Noach will end up in debates that he can't win. And so Hashem says, I don't want him to do that. And the idea, the application, the reason I bring it here is to say, not everybody is suited and not every situation is suited for that kind of give and take. Sometimes you're the minority and the social pressure is going to be too strong. And especially when those who present the other ideas can present them in a very appealing way. I love this piece from Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. It's an essay called Torah and General Culture, Confluence and Conflict. Source number 14. He says, in sage and serious works, elements of motifs that might be problematic in their own right are depicted within a context grounded in the artist's ethical vision, which passes implicit judgment upon them and provides moral perspective. In other words, when you listen to music, read a book, watch a movie, you are getting the perspective of whoever it is who wrote the song, who filmed the movie, who wrote the book, whatever it is. And they are, in the way that they present the story, biasing the reader towards their perspective. It's all in the way they choose to present it. He gives you an example. He says, I'm jumping to the last part of it. In many respects, a novel in which authority is invariably vested in the hands of rigid pedants, while its opponents are imaginative and gentle, is more insidious than nihilist manifestos, right? If you have a story in which the rabbi is this very stern authoritarian figure who has no sense of humor and no compassion and so on, and on the other hand, the people who want to break free of the rules of religion are presented as being very sensitive and caring and all of that, it biases the reader. And that is an example of how, you know, in very subtle ways often, views can be presented in ways that make them appealing and can bias the reader and can bias the viewer. And the reality is that reason itself is not infallible. We sometimes make incorrect inductions when we use our reason. The Kuzari says that in source number 13. He's trying to show why tradition can be stronger or revelation can be stronger than logical argument. And the Chaber, which is the Jew who's speaking in the Kuzari's dialogue, the Chaber said, if they would tell you that the king of India was a generous man, worthy of being exalted and of honoring his name and speaking of his deeds, based on hearing that the people of his land are righteous and of good character and they deal in good faith, would you have to believe this about the king? Meaning, if someone says to you, the people in India are wonderful people, therefore the king must be wonderful, would that be an accurate judgment? And the Khazar king replied, how would I have to believe this? I will be unsure whether the righteousness of these people from India is their own, and they have no king, or whether their righteousness is due to their king, or whether it is from both together. He says, why would I have to believe that it's because the king is good? There are lots of other ways that you can interpret the data. Reason doesn't have to lead you in only one direction. And that's why I bring you source number 16 from William James, where he says, there is only one thing a philosopher can be relied upon to do, and that is to contradict other philosophers. Right? They're all going to analyze the data and come to their own conclusions. So because of all of this, because you live sometimes as a minority in a society, and because the views of others may be presented in a particularly appealing way, and because reason itself is fallible, the Rambam says, I don't think it's a good idea for you to be exposed to things that are going to take you away from Judaism. That's the argument. So that you get Rabbi Menachem Meiri in source number 17, who makes the statement, I'm going to flip to my English translation. He says, and those who are close to their government, since they need to know Greek wisdom for various royal practices, for the Greeks were intensely drawn after philosophical investigation, it was permitted for them to learn it. You need it? Fine. Also, complete sages who have already filled their stomachs with meat and wine, meaning Torah, Talmud, and the secrets of its mitzvot, there is no one who is more close to the government than they are. Meaning, they're close to God. They may learn it in order to respond to it and to strengthen religion with nails lest it falter. They can learn it in order to respond to it. So what we've seen is that the story of this ban seems to be about fear of assimilation. Right? That's what we've basically come to at this point. But I'm stuck with a question. Why is Greek more of a concern than other cultures? What does the story have to do with Greek wisdom per se? Especially when the Greeks aren't around at this point. Yes, Nanette.
I think it has to do with seduction.
Yeah.
In the sense that the Greek wisdom, it ties very well with the third argument as to why not to comply. Because it is so beautiful. Because there is so much beauty in Greek culture and Greek wisdom and Greek art and Greek philosophy. And it's the seduction that is that we have to be concerned with.
Mm-hmm.
If I may, I just want to use a quick analogy.
Yeah.
So when I was a drug prosecutor for many years, and the way I would deter my children, the way I deterred my children in terms of drug of not taking drugs, was I said that I thought that cocaine would be wonderful. I bet heroin is like delicious and seductive. It's not that it's horrible initially. It's that the seduction and what it will ultimately mean. And so I think that the third example that you use, the Ramban, is about snoot. Because what we make the decision is that we are not able to resist the temptation, the seduction of that, and it is also equally bad and toxic for us.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I think Greek wisdom, as opposed to Roman, which was really an imitation,
right,
and wasn't at the level and didn't have the seduction that Greek wisdom did. And with respect to the Hindu example, which I think was really very clever, is it speaks to what scientists talk about, which is causation, that they confuse.
Yes.
That they confuse the fact that events are occurring at the same time as one caused the other. And that is a scientific mistake of the analysis of the data.
Right. And it happens all the time.
And it happens all the time.
Yeah.
I think that's an excellent story. Yeah. An excellent story.
Well, I didn't make it up. Credit the Kuzeli.
It's still excellent.
Yes. So definitely the appeal that Greek culture has is a strong part of this. I'm going to go in a direction which blends that a little bit with something else, but I think you're right. And as Claudette said, you know, look at Egypt and look at Rome. You know, Greek culture in many ways took over. You know, it's certainly true. Any other thoughts before I go into where I think there's an added element to the Greeks? So to me, Greek culture is not only a threat because of its hostility or even its beauty, it's also a threat because it is so similar to Judaism. It's very, very similar to Judaism. First of all, when we talk about their language, take a look, please, at source number 18 from the Jerusalem Talmud. Rabbi Yonah, son of Beit Guvrin, said, Arba lishonos noim sheyishtamesh bohen ha'olam. He says there are four beautiful languages in this world. Ve'eluhein, and here they are. La'az can mean a lot of different things, but in this case it's a reference to Greek. La'az lezemer, for song. Romi, meaning Latin. Likrav, for battle. Sursi, which is Aramaic. La'alya, which is a term for wailing, and Ivri, Hebrew is what is meant here, Lidibur, for speech. V'yesh omrim af ashuri liktav, and some say the Assyrian alphabet is good for writing. And then Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says, af bisfarim lo hitiru sheyikasvu ela yavanis. He says, when writing sfarim, when writing Tanakh, the only language you're allowed to use besides Hebrew is Greek. They said only Greek is good for translation of Torah. Now, earlier you saw that Greek is not good for translation. In the source that we saw, which one was it? It was Maseches Sefer Torah. Said that it's not good for translating it. But this source in the Talmud Yerushalmi has the view that no, it is actually good for translating the Torah, and it's the only one that's good for translating the Torah. I'll give you another example. Take a look at source number 19, a play off of a pasuk. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer, Af besfarim lo hitiru sheyikasvu ela yevanis. Sfarim, meaning Tanakh, may only be recorded in Greek. Amar Rabbi Avo, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Halacha Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. The law follows Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. You may only record them in Greek. And Rabbi Yochanan said, what's Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel's reasoning? And he quotes you from Noach's blessing to his kids. Amar Kra, Yaft Elokim liyefes v'yishkon be'ohole shem. Now he translates this way. May God beautify Yefet. That doesn't have to be the word Yaft. It can mean to broaden, but we're reading it here as to beautify. V'yishkon be'ohalei shem, and he should dwell in the tents of shame. So the way that the Gemara here reads that pasuk is that Yefet should dwell in the tents of shame. You follow? That's the way that he's reading the pasuk. Yaft Elokim liYefet, God should beautify Yefet, and Yefet should dwell in the tents of shame. Shame is us. Shame is our ancestors, Semites, right? That's why they call us Semites. The tents of shame are the places where we study Torah. And Yefet is the ancestor of Greece. Yefet has a bunch of kids. One of them is Yavan, Ionia, Greece. So Yefet, Greece, should dwell in the study halls where Torah is studied. That's the idea that he is expressing. I should note there are other ways to explain that pasuk, including to say God should beautify Yefet, break, and then Yishkon, God should dwell in the tents of shame. Not that Yefet should dwell in the tents of shame, but that's the way it's being read right here in the Gemara, is that Yefet, Greece, should be brought into the tents of shame. So that makes us very close. And in fact, over time, Jews were drawn to Greece. If you take a look at source number 20, Mishnah in Shkalim, talks about the Second Temple and the vessels that they kept there for storing the Shkalim when people came to give their half shekel. And then they had to take out every period, they would take out some of the shkalim to spend, to use. So we're told that they used three boxes. Excuse me. Oop. Have to sneeze, but can't sneeze. Oh, well. The three boxes were used, and they marked the boxes Aleph, Bet, Gimel. And if you read down the source, you find out Rabbi Yishmael said they didn't mark them Aleph, Bet, Gimel. They marked them Alpha, Beta, Gamma. That's what they're marking them the boxes with. And the reason is because that was more familiar to people. And then you jump to source number 21 from the Jerusalem Talmud, and you hear that people are reciting Shema in Greek. They didn't know Hebrew. People are reciting it in Greek, right? You see the word that's used there, Elonistin, from Hellenist. Right? They're reciting Shema in the Greek. So their language was something that was admired and adopted. Their values in certain areas were not that far from the values of Jews. If you look at source number 22 from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy on ancient ethical theory, in the ancient world, courage, moderation, justice, and piety were leading instances of moral virtue. We love those values, right? Those are values that certainly resonate with Jews. If you look in source number 23, the Mishnah makes reference to Sifrei Homerus, which commentators suggest is referring to Homer's epics. That's what it's talking about. And Homer's epics evidently were being studied and entered into a discussion about which texts are considered sacred and which texts are not. Their values were very attractive to people. Their stories were very attractive to people. I'm going a little quickly, just because I'm watching the clock here. And I have to go to Mincha soon. But also their beliefs regarding the soul and the immortality of the soul. They evolved similar ideas to ours. They talked about the idea, I gave you one example here in source number 24, the idea that the soul is drawn by certain things in this world when it recalls that before it entered this world, it was in a world of pure truth, pure perfection, and it recognizes something like it in this world, and then it is drawn to it. Which is very reminiscent of number 25, where we talk about a person in utero learning the entire Torah before entering this world. So when our sages are concerned about being drawn to other cultures, they see Greek culture as a particular threat. It isn't like any other culture. It is specifically its own thing. So Ricky asks in the chat, is it that the Greeks took these ideas from the Jews? And the answer is, maybe. Entirely possible. I mean, I don't know enough to know history of philosophy and so on, but I don't see why not. When our sages are concerned, though, about being drawn to other cultures, Greek culture really stands out. So the upshot of all of this it's simplistic to say that we hated the Greeks because they kept us from observing Judaism. There was a lot of assimilation by persuasion going on, as we saw. But particularly given the way that Hellenism resembles so much of Judaism, we gain an understanding that that would have been a particular concern for us, as exemplified by the old man in that story. They're starting to work again on the wall, it sounds like, next door, but I basically have completed what I was thinking. The last source is from Rav Kook about the point of examination and not just having faith, but also making sure that one uses one's mind to examine lest one become frustrated. There's a lot to be said about that, but it's going to have to wait for another time. I wish you a Chag Sameach, and God willing, we will learn again in a few weeks.
Safe.